Thank you very much for that glowing introduction. Unfortunately, there are too many members of my family here who know that that just can't all be true. My thanks to Bill Campbell for the kind invitation to address this august group this morning. I have a few comments that are going to be based primarily on Tocqueville, but also on the understanding of America that I gleaned living away from America for a number of years. It changed my perspective in some ways. When Alexis de Tocqueville visited America in the 1820s, he marveled at the dazzling array of private voluntary associations which were flourishing throughout America. Their vibrant sweep encompassed religious, moral, social, and educational purposes. There were hospitals and schools, missionary societies, orphanages, houses for reforming girls from the street. These private societies aided the poor, both black and white, the senile, the morally fallen, and the abandoned. This was a stunning discovery for a European who had never seen citizens voluntarily organize themselves for such concerns. The Europeans that I was living among in 1989 were somewhat flabbergasted when I initiated a private outreach in West Germany to aid refugees who were fleeing communist countries at that time. It hadn't really occurred to them to just do what they could, even though, of course, the needs were overwhelming. "That's so American," they said. I thought it was a perfectly normal thing to do. In the end, some of them were willing to follow my lead. Perhaps there is something quintessentially American about the idea of organizing to meet the needs of our fellow human beings. It has become a part of our character as a nation. I believe it's an important part of the American soul. This is a part of what has made America both great and good. From the earliest days in the colonies, when neighbors drained the swamp on one man's property and helped the next settler clear stumps from his land, Americans have demonstrated a willingness, and they've also demonstrated their character in helping one another. If the parents of a child fell ill or died, it was understood that another family would care for that child as their own. They did this because this is who they were. This is what people of character do. Tocqueville notes, almost with bemusement, that Americans do such things without a lot of fanfare. As he writes in Chapter 8 of Democracy in America, "The Americans are fond of explaining almost all the actions of their lives by the principle of interest rightly understood. They show with complacency how an enlightened principle of regard for themselves constantly prompts them to assist one another and inclines them willingly to sacrifice a portion of their time and property. They're more anxious to do honor their philosophy than to themselves." But there's more to this philosophy than meets the eye. The American impulse to assist each other comes from a very specific understanding of history and purpose and faith. This is a country that was founded in faith. A number of our fellow Philadelphia Society members have written about this eloquently over the years, among them Russell Kirk in his book, The Roots of American Order, M. Stanton Evans in The Theme is Freedom. There have been many, many others. More recently, Michael Novak has written this in his new book, On Two Wings. Novak writes that the American eagle mounts on the wings of both faith and reason. The colonists believed that they had a unique role in history as the new Israel, and that they had been granted freedom with a unique responsibility to use it wisely. In Novak's words, "Practically to a man, Americans understood that they would meet their judge at death for an account of how they had used their liberty. They believed that their progress or decline would be measured by God's standards. They believed, and I quote, that the Creator endowed us with liberty and inviolable dignity, while the divine judge shows concern for the weak and humble, that life is a time of duty and trial, and that history is grasped as the drama of human liberty." This is the predominant worldview that guided the founding of this country, regardless of most modern critics. Implicit in this view are some of the answers to the crucial questions: liberty for what purpose? Of what does a good life consist? The answers to these questions birthed the character of the nation, and they contain, I believe, the seeds for the prospects of our nation's renewal. The people who settled America made a covenant with God, a God they believed would hold them accountable for their actions and judge them accordingly. "I tremble," Thomas Jefferson wrote in The Silence of the Night, "when I reflect that God is just." Americans understood liberty not as license, but as freedom to do what they ought, an understanding that has been articulated variously by people like John Adams, Lord Acton, Edmund Burke, and others. The freedom to do what we ought. The founders understood that we were obligated by our faith to live honorable and upright lives, to show compassion for the weak, and to utilize our freedom to act virtuously. Tocqueville discovered an ethos of volunteerism which was closely tied to an understanding of personal virtue. He writes, "In the United States, hardly anybody talks of the beauty of virtue, but they maintain that virtue is useful and prove it every day. It's held as a truth that man serves himself in serving his fellow creatures, and that his private interest is to do good. By engaging in outreach to widows and orphans and the infirm, there was something taking place here that was very important to shaping American character and the nation because of the character of the individuals. As people engage in voluntary acts of this kind, they're practicing virtue. If they do it often, it can become a part of their character. It's what theologians call acquired virtue, which can become a part of us as we exercise our will." Tocqueville describes the American version of civic virtue this way. "The principle of interest rightly understood produces no great acts of self-sacrifice, but does suggest daily acts of small self-denial. By itself, it cannot suffice to make a man virtuous, but it disciplines a number of citizens in habits of regularity, temperance, moderation, foresight, self-command. And if it does not lead men straight to virtue by their will, it gradually draws them in that direction by their habits." At the time that Tocqueville observed this rich flowering of voluntary associations in America, they had really become a part of the character of who we were as a nation. You see, Americans, in caring for one another, had created this thriving civil society at the same time as fostering development of character in these seedbeds of virtue. Bruce Cronin has also written about this in his book. I believe it's titled Burke, Virtue and the Promise of Conservatism. This seedbed is most fertile in face-to-face relationships and small civic units, in the tradition articulated by Edmund Burke, who spoke of the little platoons and subdivisions of society which made it thrive. In a passage which echoes Burke, Tocqueville argued, "Man has been created by God in such a way that the larger the object of his love, the less directly attached he is to it. His heart needs particular passions. He needs limited objects for his affections to keep them firm and enduring. In other words, it's impossible to love humanity. God has created us to love individual people. As we do, we are knitting up the fabric of our social culture." There have always been two very strong tendencies in America, one outwardly directed toward voluntary cooperation, the other inwardly directed toward individualism. Tocqueville concluded that as long as we lived in a healthy tension between these two, between individualism and voluntary cooperation, the society would remain stable and healthy. But a strong penchant for individualism always has threatened the tendencies of community. Don Eberle writes about this in his recent book, The Essential Civil Society Reader. He says that Tocqueville feared that absent an aristocratic system to hold the bonds of society together, this driving freedom, always seeking to expand, would loosen the social cohesion by the ills that were the target of Tocqueville's concern: materialism, individualism, and egoism. These maladies, if left unchecked, were capable of placing freedom itself at risk. If we fast forward to the 21st century, we see that the social fabric, which was once held together in this healthy tension, has now been rent asunder. In the years since Tocqueville wrote, the pursuit of virtue has been replaced with the pursuit of pleasure. Materialism and egoism are writ large, and the cult of the individual is upon us. Magnanimity has been replaced with jealousy, contempt, isolation, loneliness, and cynicism. The character of the country is crippled by divorce, violence, corruption, greed, and illegitimacy. The soul of the republic is sick. While America enjoyed a long flowering of voluntary activity in civil society, there was a stark decline throughout the New Deal, particularly through the Great Society, which has continued to plummet to even newer lows and lower lows since. Robert Putnam chronicles this in his book, Bowling Alone, documenting the decline of civic participation, particularly since the 1960s. everything from the Elks and the Moose Lodge to bowling leagues, hence the title. Even that pillar of America, the church, has hollowed as engagement outside the walls of the church has also diminished. The America that once bloomed in a rich social fabric of voluntary activities has shriveled, and with it an important part of the American soul has atrophied. In a way, Tocqueville foresaw this bowling alone phenomenon. He warned that a creeping paralysis grows from what he diagnosed as a calm and considered feeling which disposes each citizen to isolate himself from the mass of his fellows and withdraw into a little society formed to his taste. He gladly leaves the greater society to look after itself. Our communities have now been replaced with gated communities. Our family life has shattered on what Bill Bennett calls the broken hearth. Our concept of virtue is tattered. Our faith is muzzled and emasculated. And we wonder that so few live honorably. We glorify ambition and selfishness and wonder that so few are charitable. Modern man has severed the ties to family and community and blandly meanders from one job to the next, one city to the next, one partner to the next, without commitment, passion, or permanence. Robert Bella, in his book, The Habits of the Heart, calls this contemporary creature the radically unencumbered and improvisational self. Severed from the ties of geography, tradition, clan, or community, he floats. The malady of our country is a malady of the heart. Instead of defining ourselves by a concept of virtue, whether Roman, Hebraic, or Christian in origin, modern Americans have come to define themselves by the right to be left alone, to do whatever we please. Gone is the rootedness to family, to place, and to moral duty. Happiness is increasingly expressed by material consumption. Tocqueville foresaw this also, warning that closely linked to extreme individualism was an inordinate love of material pleasure. The breakdown in America has created two polarities, the up-and-outers and the down-and-outers. Now, the down-and-outers we hear a great deal more about. This is a person who seeks solace in a rock of crack or a needle, a rebellious teenager who takes to the streets and ends up selling his body. It could be the kid who finds the family that he never had in a gang, or the single mom who goes to jail, leaving a six-year-old behind to take care of a toddler. There are whole sections of cities now without fathers. These are the bitter fruits of our contemporary culture for the down and outers. But let's take the up and outers, a somewhat more perplexing phenomenon. The driven business executive who sells his shares for early retirement only to discover that the family he wanted to spend it with has imploded in his chronic absence. Or the teenager who celebrates his 16th birthday getting a new Mercedes convertible and blows his brains out with his father's handgun. Or perhaps the pediatrician who is beloved in the hospital but doesn't have time for her own children. Or the male midlife crisis that roars full throttle into a hot sports car and a new woman. These are the up and outers, people of means who have discovered that what they own and what they earn does not necessarily satisfy the heart. What do these two worlds have to do with each other? I would suggest that the answer to that question holds one of the seeds to the renewal in this country. We live in a culture that is relationally impoverished and spiritually crippled, both for the up and outer and also for the down and outer. We all yearn in the depth of our soul for relationship, and there is a need in us that transcends the boundaries of race and geography and income. What heals a shattered life is a human touch. If we build relational one-to-one bridges, both the up and outers and the down and outers can be healed. Henry Nouwen understood this in a way that very few people did. He left his professorship, Ivy League, where he'd been teaching theology for years, and he left it to spend his final years in a community in L'Arche, in Toronto, serving the mentally handicapped. As he put it, he went to live among the broken in order to become healed himself. There are remarkable people in America today who are leading a quiet revolution. They are not looking to the government to solve the problems of the least, the last, and the lost. They've decided to solve them themselves, one person at a time. Because of their conviction, they are driving into unsavory neighborhoods to tutor kids in schools who probably would have fallen irretrievably behind. They're walking into gang front confrontations to broker truces. They're mentoring rebellious teenagers who were headed for either a coffin or jail, and they are turning them into mannerly young men. They're scooping up broken-down drug addicts and loving them into wholeness. They're reconciling prisoners with the victims of their crimes, and they're changing their hearts. These are the modern-day counterparts to the voluntary associations that Tocqueville saw. These are the armies of compassion today. I've spent the past 7 years with these people in cities across America, and they are doing remarkable work. These people do what they do without much fanfare, and without much money, I might add. Most of them do it because of their faith in God. And while they may not have read Tocqueville, they are living out what he wrote about in demonstrating virtue. They believe that God will judge them by how they have cared for the weak. They are a remarkable, yeasty group. They are black and white. They are Latino. They are Republican and Democrat. They are Jewish and Methodist and Baptist and Pentecostal and Roman Catholic. Some of them are former drug addicts. It's a colorful crowd. Some of them are gang members. Some of them are CEOs. Some of them are even professors. These armies of compassion are today's renewers of civil society and social fabric, and they are transforming through love. There is something taking place in these small transactions that changes both the heart of the giver and the receiver. It forms an ellipse. The giver receives, the receiver gives. It becomes something that changes because it's done with love. Now, I believe that there are three realms: government, the economy, and what I'll call the third sector. In the government realm, power is the medium. In the economic realm, money is the medium. However, in this third sector, it operates by a different logic. The more power and money you give away, the less you have yourself. But in the third sector, the more love you give away, the more you create. Faith in God is the ultimate source of love, I believe, and the headwater of the streams of virtue. We cannot sustain the republic in the absence of faith or virtue. The Romans knew this, and they looked, and their understanding permeated the founding of this country. The founders looked more to Montesquieu than Locke, and Montesquieu made it very clear that for a republic to flourish, its citizens must exemplify virtue. This is exactly the same conclusion that John Adams reached. He drove the point home, saying, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Freedom must be tethered by virtue and girded by faith, or freedom will fail." Although a republic depends on the moral content of its people, there is very little the political realm can do to encourage and actively foster virtue. It can exhort, it can draw the dividing line between people and the consequences of their actions. It can protect freedom, it can punish infractions to property and person. But it cannot teach the human heart to desire good and shun evil. Government cannot instill the appetite to seek God's will as the highest good. This isn't its job. This is the serious business of the third sector, which transmits virtue and builds character in families, neighborhoods, churches, and synagogues, in personal, voluntary relationships. The government can't love. Only individual people can. Yet this is the glue that holds our society together. This is as long as we have flourished. This kind of personal face-to-face relationship has created and fostered civil society. To the extent that we have lost these face-to-face relationships, we've lost an important part of the American soul. This is what made America personal, warm, even luminescent. We've been showered with grace in this country, but how do we use it? If you receive grace and never pour it out, we'll never experience the power of fresh streams of living water. Peter Kreef tells us, there's one important difference between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. Both are fed by the River Jordan, but one flows outward, the other does not. Water that has no outlet becomes brackish and eventually incapable of sustaining life. Until we as individuals demonstrate the virtue of agape, we will never know the joy of serving others. How we use our liberty matters very much. The American culture now has an opportunity for renewal through our people putting their faith into action. We cannot sustain a republic without virtue. We cannot sustain virtue without faith. I believe that people of faith and goodwill now have the capacity to change this country. Hear the call of Mother Teresa, who in her words simply asked us to do something beautiful for God. God has promised he is with us if we obey. In the words of the prophet Isaiah, and I'm concluding, If you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in darkness. Your light will become like the noonday. The Lord will guide you always and satisfy your needs in a sun-scorched land and will strengthen your frame. You will be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. Your people will rebuild the ancient ruins and will raise up the age-old foundations. You will be called the repairer of broken walls, restorer of streets and dwellings.